Get a blooming move on. The Self-Preservation Society. Quincy Jones, believe it or not, from the film, from the iconic British film, The Italian Job. This year marks the 50th anniversary of the British cult movie classics, The Italian Job, and it presents a unique opportunity to celebrate the film with a coffee table book packed full of images, insights and revelations, loaded with 60s swagger, governor, and famed for his endlessly quotable dialogue, and one of the most impressive car chases in movie history. The Italian Job is the ultimate celebration of cool Britannia before it even happened. Delighted to be joining me live on the line, author of The Self-Preservation Society, 50 years of The Italian Job, Matthew Field. Matt, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Charles. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I've got a smile on my face the size of a Cheshire cat just listening to that. It is, isn't it? The one of the greatest movies ever made.
It is indeed. And, you know, just before we go on to talk about the film, let's just talk about that song for a second. I was with the lyricist Don Black yesterday, who wrote that song with Quincy Jones. And he said, you know, that song came about because Quincy Jones, being, you know, a jazz musician from America, came over to London to score the picture. And he was just fascinated by this Cockney rhyming slang that Michael Caine kept quoting to him. And so they literally just put all of those, up the apples and pears, all those together and made a song out of it.
And it's the thing about The Italian Job is that it's got names in it that you kind of forget about, because you think it is Michael Caine and you're supposed to blow the bloody doors off, etc. And you know Noel Coward's in there as well, playing one of the greatest understated criminals of all time. But you forget that people like Quincy Jones are involved in it. You forget that people like Robert Powell are in it. You forget that people like Benny Hill are in it.
Yeah, no, that's a really interesting point. And in fact, that really goes down to the producer, Michael Dealey. I mean, when he took Troy Kennedy Martin's script, the first draft, it was much, much darker, much more political. It had a serious message to it. You know, Troy was interested in writing, you know, a gangster movie, maybe more along the lines in tone to Get Carter, a film Michael Caine made a couple of years later. But the framework was there, the idea and the plot was there. And Michael felt that it needed to be much lighter. And that's what he did. He did that by casting Benny Hill, Irene Handel, you know, Jean Lemessurier, Fred Emmy. And all those sort of like cameo roles. I mean, we even had a DJ in there. Simon D from the 60s had a cameo role in The Italian Job.
So what's the genesis then? Because we all know, you know, this cheeky chappy, you know, cars go zipping through Italy, ripping through Torino, Fiat's heartland, for goodness sake. And it's all very 60s and swinging London. But what was the genesis of the book behind The Italian Job then?
Well, it was written by, as I said, Troy Kennedy Martin, who had great success on British TV with Z Cars, and he really wanted to break into movies. And this was his idea. He had this great idea for a heist, and his brother had actually written a play for the BBC in the mid-60s when they were just putting traffic lights in along Oxford Street in London. And it was all starting to become computerized. And he thought, this is a great idea for a robbery movie. But it was too big for the BBC. And so he abandoned it and he sold it to his brother. And Troy took it and decided to set it in Italy. And at the time, it's all actually quite interesting, quite relevant to now, because this film was a reaction to the UK going into the common market. The underlying theme of it was our suspicion of the Europeans and could this work for us, could this not, you know, self-preservation for England, all that kind of thing. All done in good humour, of course. So it's quite interesting that here we are 50 years later, we're having that very same debate as we celebrate the 50th anniversary of this film.
Oh my goodness, we brought a Brexit angle into The Italian Job. Is nothing sacred, Matt?
Absolutely.
Now, what are the other things about The Italian Job? As a petrol head, and I believe that you too have a connection with a certain Mini make, is the cars. From the opening shots, of course, where there's a beautiful orange Lamborghini Miura to the E-types that get crushed. I mean, all the beautiful cars that are involved. Now, you've got a special thing for Minis, but the cars are an integral part. And when you think of The Italian Job, you always think of them about the motors.
Absolutely, and as you said, the Minis are what drew me into the film originally. I first saw the film in about 1985 when I was about 4 years old. My dad showed me the Mini Cooper car chase. And, you know, we had Minis in our family. Both my grandmothers drove them. So I was just hooked on this car chase, seeing these Minis doing these incredible stunts, you know, going down stairs through the gallerias, through the palazzos, you know, jumping buildings through sewers into the back of a moving coach. I thought this was amazing. But as you said, even though we remember it for the Minis, there's this slew of other cars that appear in the movie, beginning with that Lamborghini Miura. And I don't know if you've seen this, but very recently Lamborghini have confirmed that they have identified that car, and it's still alive and well to this day.
Oh, blimey, because that was, well, yes, because that's, you know, one of the tragedies of the film, isn't it? What was, just going back, by the way, your granny's having Minis. They had Mini Thousands, didn't they?
Yes, they did, yeah.
My grandma had a Mini 850, so your grannies were obviously more racy than my grandmother.
Yeah, one had a chocolate brown Mini 1000, the other had a maroon Mini 1000. In fact, because of that, I decided to dedicate this book to them, because this is where my love for the movie began.
And why do you think it's got the? I mean, Michael Caine at that point, was he just done? Obviously, he'd done the Ipcress Files. I mean, he was an established star. So, what brought him into the project? Did he get involved immediately? Did he come into it later? Was he the driving force behind it?
Well, actually, he kind of was. Troy Kennedy Martin always wrote the part with him in mind. He tailor-made this character, Charlie Croker, for Michael Caine. And he followed him all over the place trying to get his attention. He followed him down to Cannes and tried to get his attention at a party in Cannes, and that didn't work. And then next thing, he bumped into him in Los Angeles and tried to get his attention on the set of a movie that Michael Caine was shooting over there. And eventually Troy looked at it and said, yeah, you know, this could be really interesting, this could be fun. And it was Michael Caine that then took it to Paramount, because he just had a big hit with Paramount with Alfie. And he showed it to the new owner of Paramount, this script, and said, look, I think this is the next script we should do. And that's how he became involved.
And it's very much, isn't it? I mean, it is very much one of the last hurrahs of the 60s. I mean, it's 1969 it came out, and it's got all that sort of the effortless cool of like a post-Alfie Michael Caine in a caper running around Europe. You know, it's got the girls, it's got the cars, it's got the music, and it's got Noel Coward.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think if this film had come 2 years later, maybe it just quite wouldn't have worked the way it did, you know?
So what do you think, I mean, what do you think the enduring charm is of it then? Do you think it is that whole heady combination?
I think it is, but I also think that a lot of the elements of it are still fashionable today. I mean, take Michael Caine. He had an iconic rebirth. He's in the mid to late 90s. Still there today. I mean, Christopher Nolan, the director, cast him in pretty much every movie he makes. You know, the Batman films, he won another two Oscars. He's still really cool. He's still very well respected and still very popular. So I think that's really helped the movie. Then I think the Mini, the fact that the Mini as a brand is more popular today, and the car is, this year is actually celebrating its 60th anniversary. So it's a double celebration that we're celebrating this year. And, you know, they've sold 10 million of those new Minis. And that's just become a really popular car, not just here, but also in America. If I should tell you, the official launch of the book, we're actually launching it at Mini itself, at the plant in Oxford, with a screening of the movie, a charity screening, which we're very much looking forward to.
Indeed, you've got a pretty full-packed series of events, including the Goodwood. Is it the Goodwood Festival of Speed they're going to be at?
We're going there as well.
Oh, that's going to be hellish for you. You must be really upset about that.
No, we've had some great things lined up, and we've already done already talked at the RAC Club in London. We went to Brooklands last Friday for a talk there, and we were celebrating the actual anniversary of the movie, which was on Wednesday at the Curzon Cinema in Mayfair. We've got lots more that we're doing. In fact, we're going to Turin in October for a celebration down there. Some of the cast and crew are coming back to the location for the first time since 1969. We're screening the movie in an art house cinema in Turin. So we've got lots more to look forward to in this anniversary year.
And how were they allowed to shoot in Turin? Agnelli was still alive and kicking and running Fiat at the time. I mean, surely he must have felt this a bit of nose snubbing if he had these British cars touring, you know, tearing around his home city.
Well, do you know what? If it wasn't for him, Giles, this film wouldn't have been made the way it was. He was so accommodating. Michael D, the producer, was very good friends with Lord Harlech, who knew Gian Agnelli, and he introduced them both. And Dealey went over to Turin, and Agnelli said, look, whatever you need, I'll help you. And those traffic jams, which were created for real,
right,
were done because Agnelli instructed the police just to take no notice and look the other way. So while the camera van blocked off one entrance to the city, the costume van blocked off another, the catering van blocked off another, they just allowed this traffic just to keep coming into the city. So it got absolutely choked with traffic and looked fantastic on camera. And that was all down to Agnelli. But the great story of what he brought to this movie was when the makers of the Mini couldn't see the benefit that this was the greatest car commercial of all time. Remember, this was long before movies, product placement, of course. They really didn't help as much as they should have or could have. But Agnelli said, look, if you switch those Minis for Fiat 500s, I'll give you as many Fiats as you want. I'll even give you the stunt drivers to drive them. But how about this? I'll give you $50,000 for putting the cars in the film, and I'll give the producer a gift of a free Ferrari. And Dealey had to turn it down because he knew that the essence of the movie was these British cars. These guys had to have Mini Coopers. Otherwise, the whole essence of the movie was going to be lost. It had to be Minis. So he lost the free Ferrari to keep the Minis in the film.
That's what you call the ultimate sacrifice for your art there, Matt, isn't it, basically?
It is.
And we're talking late 60s for a Ferrari as well, not one of those mid-70s jobs or whatever. We're talking classic Ferrari. Exactly. What was the shoot like? I mean, apart from the fact that if you were trying to drive into Turin on that particular Friday and you got blocked in for no reason, was it a happy shoot? Did the cast and crew get on? Did they leave their egos, as the Americans say, did they leave their egos at the door?
I think everyone apparently had a fantastic time in the summer of 1968 in Turin. The locals were very accommodating because they were amused by it, because a big Hollywood movie had never been shot in that city before. If you'd gone to Rome, they'd probably have been less accommodating because, film crews are in there every week. But Turin, was fascinated by this, and it was also shot during the Italian summer break. So a lot of the locals took part as extras. They probably wouldn't have been too happy if they found out about the traffic jams had been created for real, and they were caught up in that for no reason, were blocked off for hours on end. But the cast and crew had a great time. Michael Caine, who I interviewed for this book, has really fantastic memories of shooting there, and the guys that played the gang had a terrific time. They were all given free Fiat 500s for the time that they were driving around, and caused absolute merry hell driving around it like a train, this train of 10 Fiat 500s careering around Turin. So everybody had a great time making it.
And as I said, you've conducted interviews with, the great Sir Michael Caine as well. And I suppose everybody got such fond memories of the film just watching it that they must love making that trip down memory lane and talking about, the summer of 68 when they shot it.
Yeah, absolutely. But the interesting was is that I think what interests them is that when the film came out, it was a flop. Especially in America. I mean, nobody took any notice of it in America. Maggie Bly, the actress in the film, she went to see it the opening weekend in West Hollywood, the opening day. And she said her and her friend were the only people in the cinema, and that didn't improve. I mean, it just didn't connect with America at all. And even in the UK, it was only the 14th movie at the box office of that year, the top being Carry On Camping. So, the Italian Job, there was no real love for it when it first came out. It was really years later, as we moved into the 80s and after an annual screening on Boxing Day on British television, that it started to get this following. So I think for them, all these people talking about it now, it's incredible that we're reuniting some of these guys together for this, this tour that we're doing, going all over the place, discussing and promoting the book. I mean, we were with Robert Powell the other night, and he said, this is crazy, getting all these people together for the first time since 1969, because when we made the film and it came out, no one took any notice of it. But here we are 50 years later, people are welcoming us with open arms.
I mean, it wasn't Robert Powell's first film role, I think.
It was second, but I mean, it was the first time he actually, I think, had a speaking part. Of course, he went on to do major things. And again, it comes back to what you're saying at the beginning of the interview. There's so many interesting people connected with this film who all went on to do great things. I mean, even the producer, Michael Dealey, he went on to make Blade Runner with Ridley Scott, and he won an Oscar for The Deer Hunter. So they all went off to do really interesting things after the Italian Job.
And I mean, I'm just thinking about the opening weekend in Hollywood, and you're thinking it's late 90s, and an American idea of a car movie is Steve McQueen in Bullet, and then you've got which is the ultimate muscle car chase, and then you've got these very British characters, God blimey, Charlie, thundering around Turin.
Well, interestingly, when Paramount first saw a cut of the movie, the executive said, I think that we're going to have to either get Michael Caine to redub his lines, or we're going to have to put subtitles on an English film because the Americans, in Alabama are just not going to be able to understand what he's saying. And they did actually ask Caine to re-record his lines with less Cockney. So that's already, they were worried about it before it even came out.
And what was Noel Coward? Was he originally written into the film? Was he in that with that role in mind, or did he just arrive and was going to play it as Beckerman like that?
When they were looking at it, they were concerned about
Bridger. Sorry, not Beckerman. Excuse me,
Mr. Bridger. Yeah. But what they're concerned about is they didn't want to make Alfie 2. They were worried that after Michael Caine's big success, remember he'd be nominated for an Oscar for Alfie. It was a very popular movie. They were worried that the role was in a way similar. So they thought they needed another name above the title, so it didn't give that indication it was a similar movie. And this idea of Noel Coward came up. He hadn't been working. It was only 2 weeks' work to be shot in Dublin, so he wasn't going to have to pay the tax in the UK. And that's how he came in. But interestingly, he had a connection also to the director, Peter Collinson, because Peter Collinson was put in the actor's orphanage at the age of 6. He was abandoned by his parents, and he had a really rough time in there. And one of the patrons of the orphanage was Noel Coward, and he discovered him one day crying in a corner and kind of like took him under his arm. And from then on, every time he visited the orphanage, he'd always, check in on Peter, and he got him his first job in showbiz. So this, for Peter Collinson, was a way of thanking Noel Coward by directing him and casting him in one of his own movies.
Like you said, there are so many sort of undercurrents in this particular movie. That's probably what makes it such a cult, such a cult film, such a wonderful film to actually, to research and to write around. I mean, I suppose pretty much it kind of writes itself when you sit down, but also the production of the book itself, it's a coffee table book, and there are some amazing pictures in there. You must have had some fun going through the files with that one.
I was very lucky because many people have passed away since I actually started researching it, but their families have been, so generous by opening up their own archives, opening up their own photograph albums. So we really were able to pull photographs from all over the place, even just things down to telegrams and notes. And the guy, David Salamone, who was in charge of coordinating all the vehicles and sourcing all the vehicles, he gave me access to his notebooks and his, file of factors from the time. And, it's just really rich collection of information and photographs and documents that allowed us to make this a really rich coffee table book.
And talking about people who are no longer with us, we mentioned off when I talked to you a bit earlier, because there is a Spanish connection as well, because John Clive, who played the garage manager when Charlie Coco goes back to get that package out of his Aston Martin.
Yeah, absolutely. John Clive was down on the Costa del Sol for a number of years. And I interviewed him 20 years ago because I did actually do a book on the Italian job back in 2001. It was a much smaller volume, nothing compared to what we're doing now. But I spent a lot of time interviewing John, and I made a documentary later on that he participated in about the movie. And he was fantastic. And again, he went on to, he was in A Clockwork Orange. He voiced one of the Beatles in Yellow Submarine in the animation. I mean, he went on and was in some terrific things. A couple of Carry On movies, lots of television, and actually ended up becoming a best-selling novelist. But John Clive was brilliant. Did you ever have him on the show?
He was on a TV show. There was a local, a television show based in Marbella a while back, and he was a regular presenter. And I went on to do a few bits and pieces to tell people what was happening in Marbella society. But he was always eccentrically dressed, and fabulously good fun.
And I think that scene that you highlighted is one of the funniest in the film, and he's absolutely brilliant in it. And that scene, in a way, if you look at it again. The lighting cameraman Douglas Slocum, he hated that scene because when they did it, it was improvised. John Clive and Michael Caine just had this great connection, and they had the script, but they thought, let's just wander around the car, let's just get in and out of it, let's have some fun with the scene and where it takes us. But of course, there's shadows all over the place because he didn't know where to put the lights. But I think because it's improvised, that's where a lot of the fun in that scene comes from between Clive and Caine.
I never knew that, but then it seems to make perfect sense because, yes, they are bouncing off each other. It's one of the things of the of the strength of the film, though, is the fact that you said you saw it when you were four, which, you know, and it was made when I was 1 year old. But here we are talking about a film that was basically made before you were born and made yourself when I was born, but still has resonance today. I mean, every time you kind of see a Mini, even though it may be a modern version of the Cooper, you just something takes you back to the Italian Job. And in fact, they even tried a remake of the Italian Job.
And they did do a remake of it in 2003 with Mark Wahlberg. And, you know, everyone always asks me what my opinion is on that. And if I'm really honest with you, when I saw it, I didn't think it was a bad movie. But I think the fact that it hasn't stood the test of time, I mean, okay, it's still watchable, but it's not a classic. I mean, people aren't talking about it. It's not like the original has become. But, you know, as we keep saying, so many ingredients in the Italian Job which make it popular today. And in fact, I've shown the car chase to my 4-year-old son now, and he absolutely loves that scene too. And, you know, every time he sees a Mini, will, you know, say, "Oh, it's the Mini film." You know, so it has legs, and I think it will keep going. If the movie is popular 50 years later, then the movie's going to be popular 100 years later.
And finally, we can't have a discussion about the Italian Job without talking about the final scene. Now, was it improvised? Was it scripted? You know, you would have thought they would have made an Italian Job too. But then again, 1969 comes and goes. We go into the 70s. It gets a lot darker. Kane goes and makes Get Carter, which is an extremely dark and different film. So perhaps it was just as well to leave it with that sort of cheeky, chappy bit of opportunity.
Absolutely. It's a great ending. One of the most famous endings in movie history. I hope we're not ruining it for anybody that out there has.
Spoiler alert, yeah.
but the writer wrote a number of endings, all of which didn't really work. They were all talky. They all took place in banks or in offices or things like that, about them banking the gold and twists with the mafia. And it just didn't work. And Dini was on his way over to Hollywood to meet with Paramount. And he had this idea on the plane of this cliffhanger ending. And he wrote it down on a scrap of piece of paper on the plane, walked into Paramount, put it down the table and said, "What about this?" And he says he was rather selfishly thinking, well, this would be a great opportunity for a sequel. And sadly, they never made it. But then again, in hindsight, someone asked me last night, you know, would I have enjoyed the sequel? And do you know what? I think it's best left where it is. I think it's such a classic ending. It's such a classic movie. And I just don't think it needs that sequel at all.
The book is called The Self-Preservation Society, 50 Years of the Italian Job. It's written by Matthew, otherwise known as Matt Field. It's out now by Porter Press International. Matt, if people want to find out more about you or about the book, is there a website? Is the social media thing going? How can people get in touch with you or find out what you're up to?
Well, there's Facebook, there's Instagram, of course, Porter Press, the Porter Press website. It's got all the information for the book on there. We've got a collector's edition, actually, which fans may be interested in, which is signed by cast and crew. Robert Powell has signed it, Don Black, the Oscar-winning lyricist, has signed it, Michael Dealy, the producer, has signed it, and that's a limited edition of only 300, and they're going very, very fast. But the book's available directly from that website or from amazon.co.uk.
And it's also going to be available via our own bookstore, Talk Radio Europe, on tre.radio. It's very rare that I interview people and I'm extremely jealous about the work they've done, but Matt, I'm absolutely going, God, that must have been a fantastic thing to do. I suppose one of the things about the fact of the Italian Job is that, what do you drive, by the way, at the moment?
I don't know what I should tell you because it's a new Mini.
Because I was going to say, because if you drive an Audi, well, I wouldn't talk to you ever again. But the other thing is, if you know, because whenever you get, I mean, I had a Mini, I had a 1275, yellow with a black roof. Everybody remembers their Mini. Which is an absolute, people might not remember their Rover, but people will damn well remember their Mini. And I remember my 1275 with a black roof and yellow. But when you get in it, especially one of the old Minis, every time you turn it on and just go through a tunnel, suddenly you can't help thinking that you're Charlie Croker.
Absolutely, absolutely. In fact, I have got a Mini Cooper RSP, a 1990, in the garage, which has been waiting to be restored. It's actually been there now for about 5 years, but I can't wait to get that project up and running because you know, I've always wanted to have a classic Mini, and this seems a good opportunity to get one up and running. But the 1275s, I mean, I bet you wish you'd held on to that.
Oh, just
the prices of those now.
Just don't know. I was, strangely enough, there's a tunnel in Marbella, and when I was about 18 or 19 years old, and I was going through the tunnel, and I just got it out of, I was giving it to a Spanish mechanic who I think probably only dealt with Seats, and he did something with the engine, and he drained it, and he forgot to put the oil back in, and he forgot to tell me. And guess what happened?
That was the end of it.
a huge cloud of smoke, and it expired in the tunnel underneath Marbella, and I still remember the shudder that went through me at that time. So there you go. Maybe one day I'll be able to get another 127. The book is called The Self-Preservation Society, 50 Years of the Italian Job. It's by Matthew Field. Matt, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today.
Thanks very much. Bye-bye.